This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and my guest today is Steve Daly, president and CEO of Avanti, one of the largest tech companies in Utah. Avanti employs roughly 2,000 people worldwide and brings in about $500 million in revenue between their various business segments. The company's goal is to simplify the vast array of IT tasks that companies provide to keep their employees' computers and devices up and secure. Steve, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with Avanti and what its overarching goal is. I mentioned that it helps companies keep their employees' devices and computers secure and up and running. What does that mean?
Yeah, so really our vision is that if you think about in corporate environments in particular, so we sell to IT organizations, and in corporate environments, you think about how we get our job done today versus maybe even 10 years ago, it's very different, right? I started my career at Intel, and I had a desktop and a pager, and that was how I did my job. And now today, you know, we've got devices that we have with us all the time. They're always on. We usually carry at least two devices with us. We usually have a laptop and a mobile device. So it's become really complex when we talk about end user computing, and really hard for IT to keep up with that change. And so our goal is to bring all that together, make in one place we can give them the technology stack that allows them to kind of get a 360 degree view of us and what we're using, how we're using it, and then keep us up and running in a very efficient way remotely, and then make sure we're secure, that we're not doing stuff that puts the company at risk in that process.
So a lot of people here in Utah had heard of Landesk, which is kind of the predecessor to Avanti. How is that connection? How is Landesk related to what Avanti is doing?
Yeah, so we started as Landesk. It was part of Intel back in the early 90s, and that's when I got associated with the business. And Intel was selling microprocessors. You know, early 90s, 486 had come out, and desktop computing was just starting to take off. And what Intel recognized was the cost of owning a desktop and a server environment was much different than a mainframe or a mini, and it was a lot more expensive. And they saw that if that cost got out of control, it could limit the adoption of microprocessors. So Landesk was created to really lower the cost of owning those devices. Landesk went through an interesting history. We spun out of Intel in the early 2000s to go private, and then we were acquired by Avascent Corporation, a company based out of Huntsville, Alabama. That's when I came back. I had left, and I came back to Landesk. And then Avascent was acquired, and we were spun out of Avascent to private equity again as a standalone company. And since then, we've made about 10 acquisitions in the last 5 years. We had a lot of different brands that we were trying to bring under one umbrella. Landesk had kind of run its course as far as, you know, there was a lot of, you know, people were anchored on what Landesk was, but the company was so different. We had pivoted pretty radically. And so we decided, hey, now's the time to change the name. And so in January of last year, we merged with another software company that was doing similar stuff to us, and we said, hey, let's change the name. And that's when we rebranded and became Avanti.
Okay. Let me go back to Landesk, though, and just remind folks and unpackage some of what you just shared. So when the desktop came out, you know, 25 years ago or 30 years ago, everybody did not have a desktop at their desk at work. You certainly didn't have a laptop at home. You certainly didn't have a mobile device. But Landesk, as I recall, is when employees would have Word or Excel on their computers and it was time to update that, that used to be a big pain for IT people, right? They'd have to physically go to each computer. And do I remember correctly, that was kind of Landesk first thing was a way, in a centralized way, to get these updates out.
Yeah, that's exactly where Landesk started. There were kind of three things that Landesk did really well at the beginning, because, like you said, it was nobody really had an idea how to manage all of these distributed assets. And so we gave visibility just so you knew what was attached to your network. So that was kind of inventory. And then we had the ability to distribute software. So when you wanted to upgrade to the next version of Office, you could do that remotely. You didn't have to run around sneakerware and, stick a disk into every desktop to update it. And then the third piece was remote control. So if there was an issue, you didn't have to send somebody out to fix it. You could do it remotely as an IT worker from your desk.
Yeah. And back in its day, that was a big success story here in Utah, right? They were backed by a venture firm that has since pivoted themselves, but vSpring Capital, I believe, was one
of their
initials. Investors, and getting sold to Intel was a very nice exit. It was one of the local companies that there was a lot of pride in for seeing them do that. Is that
a fair
background for Landesk?
Yeah. So, well, Landesk was part of Intel, and then vSpring, along with a private equity firm out of the Bay Area, spun Landesk out of Intel. And then as a standalone company, ran for a while and then sold to Avascent, which was based out of Huntsville, Alabama. And
okay. So it actually, Landesk actually started at Intel. It was created at Intel.
That's
okay.
Right.
I missed that piece of it. Okay. And so you were at Intel. Your background, your undergrad's in mechanical engineering.
That's right.
You went to get your MBA and at BYU, and after getting your MBA, if I'm correct, Intel was your first job.
That's
after
right.
Graduating.
That's right. Right.
Okay, and that's how you got associated with Landesk.
That's how I got associated. Okay. So part of what Intel had was a program where you rotated every couple of years, and so I started up in Oregon, which is where I'm from originally, and then it came time to do a rotation, and I looked at it and said, okay. Landesk had an opening. I thought, wow, that's cool software, right? It was early 90s. It was 94, I think, when I took that rotation. Why don't I go try that? Small division within Intel. So I rotated down here to be associated, and I ended up spending about 6 of the 10 years I was at Intel associated with Landesk. But then I left right before Landesk spun out of Intel, and I went to do a startup here in Draper called Soranti, and vSpring Capital funded our startup. And so I had known Ed Ekstrom. He had been at Intel, and so that's how I was associated with vSpring. And they funded, and then about a year later, we sold that to Avascent, based again out of Huntsville, Alabama. I went to work for them and actually moved to Huntsville, and they decided that they were going to buy Landesk, and they asked if I would come back to run Landesk. And so,
were you part of what got Landesk on their radar screen?
I was, yeah. Okay. I was part of the corporate strategy team. I was running corporate strategy, and Avascent was looking at how do we expand our footprint. Well, they wanted we had a strategy at Avascent to be desktop to data center. We wanted to look at the entire infrastructure, and Avascent had a lot of data center assets, and they wanted to expand to the endpoint and the desktops, and that's why Landesk got interesting.
So, the whole job of an IT professional and how they manage and keep our devices and computers secure has changed dramatically over 20 years, and in fact, it changes every couple of years. I mean, it's such a fast-paced. Mm-hmm. Cybersecurity now is obviously very high on everybody's list. I know that's one of the suite of services that Ivanti offers. How does the cybersecurity work? Is that a third-party solution? Is that an internal solution? Are companies free to use whatever cybersecurity they want, and you can tie into that? Or how do you guys provide that service?
Yeah, it's a combination of the two. So what we see happening in the industry is that you've got a team that's really responsible for operations within IT, keeping stuff up and running, and then you've got a security team. But what happens over time is everything gets operationalized. And so things that used to be the realm of security only eventually come into the desktop operations team. And so those are the things we want to do as a company. And so things like patching your device, keep the latest patches. Patching is a huge problem, even though we've been doing it for years. Most breaches happen to vulnerabilities that a patch has already been available for
at
least
so
6 months.
Yeah, listeners know patching is like when there's an update for your phone, a lot of times it's for security reasons, right?
That's right.
We should likely all be updating when the new software is available. We should probably be updating our phones.
No, that's exactly right. And Office will bring, you know, you'll get a prompt that says, "Hey, we've got the latest security updates. Would you like to patch your system?" And so that's a huge challenge. It's those types of things that we will do. And then there are kind of the science projects that the big security companies are working on. We'll integrate into those technologies so that you can get, a 360-degree view of the end user and what they're doing and how they're doing it.
Okay. Before we leave the topic of cybersecurity, any advice for the average listener, something that's easy for them to do? We talked about updating software that they should be doing, but maybe they're not.
Yeah. In fact, there's a number of organizations that kind of publish what are the things to do. Number one and two on that list is make sure you're patching your OS and make sure you're patching the applications that are there. So that's kind of the low-hanging fruit. Do that up front, and you'll hit 85% of all risks in your environment you'll take care of just by doing those simple
things. It's not my area of specialty, but one thing I'd add, just because my IT guy has drilled it into me, is two-factor authentication on your email, your personal email. It's very easy to do. You think about it, your personal email is the gateway to all your other accounts. You can get into somebody's bank account. If you can get into their email account, you can reset their password at their bank account. So two-factor authentication, what that means is they'll send you a text and say, is this really you? Here's a code and put it in. Easy to do. You should do it. If you're just joining us this morning, my guest today is Steve Daly. He's the president and CEO of Avanti. We're right now talking about how the landscape is changing. In my research, one of the things I saw is one of your suite of services makes it easier for IT professionals to offer artificial intelligence and bot services. Mm-hmm. Tell our audience what bot services are and why big corporations are interested in that.
Yeah, if you think about what an IT person does on a day-to-day basis, a lot of times, you know, they're taking calls, very similar problems that people are having, and they're answering the same question over and over. And so what we have in the industry is now artificial intelligence is being democratized. So you have services that IBM Watson, for instance, or you have Google Mind is an artificial intelligence service. Microsoft has their own artificial intelligence service. So they've created these very high-end computing backends that now you can plug into. Anybody can plug into. And so with IT, there is a ton of data that they're collecting, right? All of those calls are being logged. All of the way they answer those calls is being logged. And so what we can do now is we can plug into those services and start to see patterns, and we can start to see where IT is doing the same thing over and over and answering the same questions, and we can let the technology take care of that. And so when we talk about a bot in IT support, for instance, this is the idea that you can go bring up a window on your PC and say, "Hey, I've got a problem," and rather than talking to an actual or chatting with an actual human being, you're actually chatting with the system. And it's looking for patterns. It's recognizing when things, and if it can't figure it out, it'll send you to a human. But it takes a lot of the load off of IT, because IT is just running ragged, trying to just keep up with keeping the lights on, and allows them to kind of focus on more of the high value areas. And for you as an individual interacting, you can't really tell the difference between your interaction with a bot versus a human.
In fact, sometimes companies don't tell you they're using a bot. Some do. Here's our automated system. But one of the things I've enjoyed doing, I use the chat services, and I think more and more we're interacting with companies through chat services. But if you just say, "Are you a bot?"
Yeah,
it'll tell you.
Yes, just to call them out.
Yes, I am. And sometimes the representatives are like, no, I'm not. And they're kind of surprised by the question, but I think that's quickly going away. No, it's pretty amazing actually how human-like that conversation feels, which is what we want. We don't want to feel like a computer gave us the response.
That's right.
It's very conversational.
That's right.
And so that technology, is that something that you acquired? You mentioned that there were several acquisitions, or is that something you developed in-house, the AI and the bot technology?
That we developed in-house. We've got a number of teams. One of the things that is changing in the software industry is we look at where we're hiring. And, we still hire a lot of software developers, but data scientist is becoming, a hot job. It's actually pretty hard. We've had to kind of spread it out across our development sites here as well as India to try to find that expertise in data scientists, because that's where I think the gravity is going. Is how do you cull through all this data? Because as an IT, as suppliers to IT, we do a really good job of just gathering a ton of data and then we just dump it onto IT. We just say, here, you go figure out, how to get insight out of this. You go, whatever you need to do, go figure it out. And so, I think the expectation is changing. The vendors in software, it's partly our responsibility now to help you glean insights from these. And I think the move to the cloud facilitates that. Because now, as a vendor, I used to sell you software, you used to install it. All of that information was on your premise, and you had access to it. I didn't ever have access to it. Now, as a cloud provider, I've got all that data sitting up in the cloud, and now I start to get a significant size of data. Then you can start to glean insights from that.
You can glean insights, and importantly, you can add tremendous value by being able to do that.
That's right.
So how do you think about it? I know you've done a number of acquisitions, the bot technology developed in-house. How do you think about, should we develop this in-house or should we look for a leader and buy them?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we look at a couple things. So we look at, one, time to market. So, if we feel like we're behind on that technology, or we think the market's evolving really quickly, we'll look at an acquisition usually for that. The second is can we build it, and do we have that expertise? A lot of times, our acquisitions will be to get the DNA into the company as much as the technology, and so we'll be looking and saying, if we know that data scientist is a big job. There's a company out there doing this. We've got a bunch of data scientists. Let's acquire that and bring them in, because one, they have the skill set. Two, they understand the industry really well, and domain expertise is something that is really hard to get. You'd have to go find that and hire it, and it takes a long time. And so those are kind of the two big.
Okay. Give us an example of a recent acquisition that you guys did and why you decided to buy versus build.
Yeah. So we bought a company based out of the Netherlands, the name was Res Software. And the reason we acquired them was because they had two pieces of technology that we really liked. One we already had in our portfolio, and so it was kind of a market consolidation for us. We got market share. The second was they had really interesting automation technology. So they'd built a very cool automation engine with a lot of connectors to a lot of different pieces of the IT infrastructure. And we knew that would apply to across all of our portfolio, and in particular for our cloud properties, to put it up in the cloud so that we could automate a lot of different workflows within an IT environment. And so that's, we approached it looking at, we don't usually do acquisitions that are just market share, because when you have overlap products, it's a hard thing to do. Is you got to rationalize products, you got to figure out what to do with the customer bases and that kind of stuff. So usually we look for technologies that's additive to our portfolio.
Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Steve Daly, president of Avanti.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the local shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Steve Daly, President and CEO of Avanti. So before the break, you had mentioned a company that you started, Soranti. And you also mentioned about a year later, you were able to sell that company. That was a successful exit. That typically doesn't happen, right? That quick of a turnaround. What did Soranti do, and how do you think you were able to position it to see that exit so quickly?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we did was we provided remote access to servers. And so we had a combination hardware-software product. You could attach it to your server, and then you could get to that server anywhere in the world, even if the OS wasn't running. And so it gave us it was interesting. I think in a lot of ways we got lucky in this process. But the thing that we got to the place we got lucky is we partnered with the largest player in the industry for that, which was Avasant. And we OEM.
I was going to guess Intel, but Avasant. Okay.
It was Avasant in that technology, and so we licensed it to them, OEM'd the technology to them, so that they could sell it under their brand. We gave them some exclusivity to do that, and so as we got and they started to see success with the product, we got towards that end of exclusivity. They started to get a little worried that we were going to go to their competition and OEM it to them, and then they'd lose their advantage. And so it kind of, we just hit it just right. They didn't have the technology. And then we got lucky that they got really worried about the competition, decided, you know, it'd be better to own us than it would to let us go to the rest of the industry.
Well, congrats on that. As I said, the story is typically 7, 10, 15 years, which oftentimes entrepreneurs don't think about.
Right.
When they say, I have this idea, I want to go after it. Okay, you're 27 years old, you're 30 years old. You know, do you see yourself doing this till you're 40 or 45, which you had 15 to 30, you will be. How about you? You were at Intel. You had a successful career. You had to make that decision. You didn't know it was going to be 13 months.
Right.
How did you think about that?
It was I didn't, to be honest. I didn't think about it. So, you know, I didn't I just it was one it was cool technology. I knew it. I knew there was a market for it, and so I just kind of went for it. And I didn't think through all that. I just kind of said, "Okay, let's go try this." And, you know, I took a huge pay cut to do it. I took a huge quality of life cut in that because, you know, it owns you when you get into a situation like that. And, it was probably naivete. Was
doing a startup something you had to do? It was just in your personal DNA?
I think so, yeah. I'd always thought that's what – when I went back to get my MBA, I had been working as an engineer, consulting engineer. My goal was to get that MBA so I could start my own consulting engineering firm. And then I pivoted coming out to go to work for Intel. But so I think it was in my DNA. I'm not sure if this opportunity – I was getting pretty comfortable, though, at Intel. I'd been moved up pretty quickly in the ranks. I was, you know, at a pretty high grade in the organization. So,
it's a secure job. You had stock options. Intel was really on a growth spurt when you were there.
Yep, exactly. And so, if it hadn't been, you know, that I knew the investor really well in Extrem, and I knew the technology, it was a couple guys had come up with the technology that were Intel people. I may not have gotten myself out of that comfort zone, but it was definitely in my DNA. I always thought I would do something
like
that.
So you went in to be the business person.
I did.
On this. So the technology kind of existed already.
Yeah, and it's an interesting. So what happened was I got a call from Ed, and Ed said, hey, I've got this really cool technology. You probably know the engineers that developed it. But my partners won't fund it unless we bring somebody in that knows how to run a business, right? Because they're a couple of engineers. And he said, so I want you to go. I said, oh, that's really interesting. He goes, okay, I want you to go over to their house tonight, and you're coming in tomorrow to pitch it to my partners. And so I went over. It was kind of a hostile environment. So I go get over there. They've got their arms crossed. They're looking at me, and they're saying,
The
technicals. Yeah. The only reason you're here is because the money – comes with you potentially, but if the money doesn't come, you're not here. So I said, okay, that's fine. We worked until, you know, 2 a.m, pulling together a slide deck, went in to meet with the Vspring partners, and it was essentially a group interview of Steve Daly at that point. And then they kind of sweated us out in this little conference room while they talked, and then they came in and said, hey, you guys, we'll find you in that process. And so it was an interesting process. It was, you know, as I think about the journey, and it was pretty quick, and so we were fortunate, I think, but the funding we got was tranched. And so they said, you know, they said, you've got to hit these certain milestones. And one of those milestones was you've got to get 5 letters of intent from different OEMs in order to get your last tranche of funding. And we were coming close to the end of that, and I was getting worried. I was thinking, we don't have them. I can see a path to get there, but it's not very likely. And so I was talking to a friend of mine who was working at Novell, and they said, hey, we got a new CMO. He's going to shake up marketing. Why don't you interview with him? And so I set up an interview with the CMO at Novell and said, hey, and as a kind of plan B in case we didn't get the funding. And what happened was it was the morning of the interview. I got on the phone. I told the guy, I said, hey, look, I've got to commit to this. I don't want to waste your time because I got to see this through. If I don't get the funding, I may be calling you in 6 weeks because I ran out of money. But let's not waste your time, which, you know, and he was very gracious. And he says, that actually reflects pretty well on you. But I said, okay, I'm in. And that's when I kind of went all in on Soranti, and I didn't have that foot on the pier and one in the boat. I was all in the boat, and that's.
Well, there's a lot there, right? That, yeah. I want to talk about, and one of them is, you know, if you know the outcome, it's easy to be all in,
right,
or all out, right?
Right, exactly.
You know, the challenge with entrepreneurship is you don't know the outcome. You give up a great job, you take a big pay cut. Your family is sacrificed. You're working harder than you've ever worked before, and nobody knows the outcome.
That's right.
And nobody knows how long it's going to take to get to that outcome. So how do you mentally, having gone through that, what advice would you give an entrepreneur?
My advice is just to be intellectually honest about it when you go into it, right, and recognize you're not going to know. And if you're not completely committed to that, if you can't jump in the boat at that point, don't do it. Because that is going to be a miserable life. My life was miserable leading up to that decision, but once you make that decision, it's freeing, because you're all in. And the reality is, you know, through my career, what I've recognized is if you're good, if you've got that, you'll figure out something to do. It's not like you're going to be destitute, you know, living on the streets if that thing goes under. So commit and get all in. It's freeing, and it's good for the business.
Yeah, you have to watch who you surround yourself with too, because there's going to be a lot of naysayers out there.
That's right.
And some of those people you can turn around with your enthusiasm for the company, but some you can't, and you kind of have to sever those ties. To the extent that you can, because you can't have that negative voice in the back of your mind the whole time. Let's talk about something else. You talked about the two technical folks, and they were resistant initially to you coming on board. And that's fairly common in the technical world, or at least it was 25 years ago when I went to business school, and several of my friends were in this situation, including one that was fortunate enough to get a meeting with Amazon about their business, and Jeff Bezos actually came in for a few minutes to talk to the team, and my buddy walked out with Bezos and said, hey, I want to talk to you. Amazon really should buy this company. And he planted that seed, and ultimately it was a huge success. But the two technical guys, that it was a very similar situation to yours. He was the first business person. And, you know, chalk that up to luck. You know, I would chalk that up to tenacity. The moment came up, he took full advantage of it, and the company sold for a lot of money because he was able to recognize that moment. But the technical guys never fully respected what my buddy's skill set was.
Yeah.
How do you manage that?
Yeah, and I found that too. And there's a couple things to unpack on that one, because one is about luck, and I do believe there's a big factor. Luck is a big factor. Now, the difference between somebody who we consider lucky and not lucky is when that luck, that opportunity presents itself, which may be through luck, is the ones that are successful will seize it, right? Warren Buffett once said, you know, life's going to pitch you all these pitches, and your goal is to pick the meatiest, juiciest one and then swing for the fence. And so from a luck perspective, I do believe luck plays a big part of it, but the ones that we consider lucky are those that seize that opportunity when it presents itself. And then, you know, as far as I've always found that there is this underappreciation maybe from technical people. That may be changing a little bit now. People are seeing it for the business side. You know, the first hire I made after I was CEO of that was to hire a biz dev guy. And he's the one that, you know, spray painted in the garage our little hardware product, walked it down on the floor at Comdex at the time, and just walked into everybody's booth and said, "Hey, we're going to start selling this. You want to OEM this from us, right?" And so I do believe there's an underappreciation at times of that.
And to be fair, it goes both ways too.
It does.
You know, we were talking about data scientists and giving folks data and here, make this happen. One of the things I did several years ago was I taught myself how to code. I took a bunch of online classes, and for 2 years, every morning, I woke up at 4:45, and for 2 hours before work started, I was taking coding classes. So I would have an appreciation of what that job was like, and also so that I could better communicate with folks that are doing it, because it's becoming a more important part of our job. And until I did it myself, you know, I didn't fully have an appreciation for it. Like with coders, you don't want to walk into the room and say, "Hey, you got any plans for the weekend? You know, it's Friday, help you." You know, they're in the zone, and it can take an hour to upload all that information it takes them to do their job, and you can't just walk in randomly and disrupt them.
That's right.
So I think it cuts both ways. But
no, I think it does. I think it does. And, you know, the reality is those two founders, I won one of them over, and I never won the other one over. Right. And so it's like anything. You just got to do your job. You got to have the strength of personality. You've got to have the conviction that what you're doing is the right thing and just move forward.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Steve Daly, president and CEO of Avanti. So we talked earlier about your undergrad being in mechanical engineering. You went to get your MBA really to be able to open your own consulting business and continue on the technical side. What was it through that experience that you said, you know, actually I wanted to focus more on the business side than the technical side?
It was the education process. So I got into MBA school and, you know, I had been used to the engineering undergrad, which was you walked into a classroom, the professor drew formulas on the board for 50 minutes and you copied them furiously and you guys talked, you know, you talked a little bit about it, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of interaction. And I got into the case study format. We at the time, it was called an integrated program where, you know, we had, in addition to the classes that were, you know, finance and marketing and all that, we spent a lot of time talking just about business problems and integrating all of those disciplines. And that really was exciting for me.
You know, my undergrad's in engineering as well. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really enjoyed about business school is in engineering, there really is a right answer and sure, there's a wrong answer. And what I loved about business school was we do the cases. Some classmates that were very bright, whose opinions I really valued, had a completely different approach to the solution to a business problem. Mm-hmm. And you'd listen to them share their reasoning. It's like, that's logical. And me and my team had come up with a different reason and had it logical. And I love the fact that there wasn't a right or wrong answer. And it was really, it had a lot to do with making good decisions and then the leadership behind it and just kind of the challenge of dealing with people. People are complex. Unlike physical devices that, you know, here's the physical laws that govern it. And so I just found that to be a really interesting challenge. And now, you know, 30 years later in my career, you know, the management side of things, the complexity, the fact that people are individuals and everybody's different and how do you lead them? Is a challenge, which is where I want to go with this. Avanti's got 2,000 employees. You're spread out 20-plus countries. You recently opened an office in Dubai. That's very spread out. How do you lead a company that's that big and that spread out?
Yeah, that's you know, I've helped a lot of boards. I've sat with a lot of CEOs in mentoring roles, and that's probably I think the biggest challenge to a CEO, a founder in particular, be able to scale to deal with the changes that you have to do as a CEO. And it really comes down to there is a ton of communication. What we're finding, and we do our employee surveys, and it's always we don't feel like we know the strategy, or we don't feel like we understand how our part of the business fits into the overall business. And so what I've found is for me it's about getting out, and you've got to get out and be with the people, right? You've got to be on site. You've got to be talking about what our objectives are. You've got to have multiple, either electronic communications, but you cannot, there's nothing that replaces being in front of people, shaking their hands, spending time with them, having lunch with them, that's not super scalable. So it ends up being a pretty heavy cost as a CEO that I don't, a lot of people aren't willing to make that, pay that price to be able to do that. But I don't know how you do it without that.
A common theme, some of your employees have been interviewed or there's recruiting videos. A common theme on your team is your value for work-life balance and how that trickles down to the team. Why is that an important cause for you? And there are tech companies here in Utah. I mean, I think Utah does a good job of work-life balance, but there are tech companies here in Utah that really are, hey, guys, we've got to be heads down for a period of time. Why is it important for you to share that message and communicate that message with your team of work-life balance?
Yeah, it's interesting because philosophically, we use the term work-life balance because that's kind of the words that we have to talk about it. The reality is there isn't a separation between those two, right? I spend a lot of time when I'm with my family. I'll still have to take a call or I'll still have to do some emails. But what we're trying to get across as a culture of the company is, look, you've got those are two aspects of those are the yin and yang of you. Right, those are the two pieces of you. So if your kid's got a soccer game at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, go see it, right? Just go see it, and that's going to be far more rewarding to you. And guess what? You've got time to do your job. We still got to get your job done, but we're not as prescriptive in how you do it. Just figure out how to mix those two and blend those two. And it's my fundamental belief that we compete. So we're 500 million. We're good scale, but we're competing against a Microsoft or a Symantec. We're these multi-billion-dollar, 10, $12 billion companies, and we believe that the way that we're going to be different than them is the relationship we have with our customers and how we treat our customers. And it's my fundamental belief that if we treat each other that way internally, it's going to translate to how we deal with our customers. And so that's really the culture. We want to create a family-like culture, which means that you're mixing a lot of different aspects of your life together. You're still doing what you need to do to get there. But if we can do that, then that permeates itself when we start interacting with our customers. And that's ultimately, I believe, frankly, I think all technology is transient, right? Everybody, you come up with a cool idea, a couple engineers in a garage in Beijing can copy it, in a few weeks. And so where I believe our long-term competitive advantage really is how we deal with those customers and that relationship we have.
Well said, well said. Another thing that employees really value is the social mission of a company, and on your company's homepage, it talks about how each employee is given 2 days a year, two full days to volunteer for any organization that they care about. How did that come to be, and what's been the impact on your company from that?
Yeah, that came as a recognition again that we live an integrated life, right? And this idea that I have my work life and I have my home life or my volunteer life, whatever, that we can't be thinking of it that way anymore. We're integrated. And And we feel pretty strongly about STEM education. You know, we've put a lot of effort in sponsoring things around STEM. And so it really started with us going to our employees and saying, hey, go into the schools and help, you know, promote STEM education, help the schools in areas where they're deficient.
But if there are things the Red Cross, they can go
whatever
their cause is.
Yeah, whatever their cause is. We had one of the great success stories is we had some of our engineers work with the Jordan School District, and they realized there wasn't a coding class. And so they went in and actually the engineers got together. They created a curriculum. They taught the class for the first time, trained all the teachers on how to do it. And now they're putting through 600 students a semester learning how to code. And so it's those types of things. It's also my belief that, you know, the workforce is changing. You look at what, you know, I talked to my daughter who's a millennial, right? And I have a buddy who works at another company who's saying, we did our all hands meeting and we were talking about the results of the company. And he said, we got feedback from the employees like, we don't care about the results of the company. What are we doing in the community? And he and I were laughing at that and lamenting it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and getting our head around it. And I was telling my wife and my daughter that. My daughter's like, yeah, I don't care about the results of the company. And I started to realize we're valuing, generations value different things. And this is an important part of what the new workforce is valuing. And so it's also, you know, in our own self-interest, I believe, to really get involved. And I like doing it. You know, it is rewarding outside of just, you know, building a business.
Now, you and I were talking in the green room ahead of time. You know, your daughter's a graduating high school senior, so is mine. So I definitely see that in my daughter as well. But we do need to also instill in them, hey, how the company does is really important because that's how we fund all these other things. So it's the secret's getting both. Last question for you. Where do you see Avanti going in the next 5 to 7 years? Where do you hope they are over that period of time?
Yeah, so we think we're doing something very unique. We have, you know, through our acquisition strategy, we have created a technology stack that's unique in the industry. So we think there's a lot of headroom in our business model and in what we're trying to do. You know, our next goal is to get to $1 billion. So, you know, 3 years ago it was to get to $250 million. We kind of blew through that. We want to get to a $1 billion company. We think that's going to look, you know, we'll probably go public sometime over that time frame. We've got now more employees outside of the U.S. than we do inside of the U.S. So we'll continue to kind of expand our global footprint and become a global company headquartered here in Salt Lake City.
Well, they say getting to your first billion is the hardest. So yeah. Hopefully going from 1 billion to 2 billion is a lot quicker than getting to the first billion. And, you know, it's an exciting time here in Utah because there's a number of companies. As we record this, Pluralsight has just announced that they're going public. I think that's going to happen later in the month of May, which is really exciting. And we have several companies, and it's good to hear that Avanti is one of those. You know, it's probably going public in the next couple of years. And there's all this tangential benefit to us here in Utah when we have companies going public, when we have employees having some liquidity events. Maybe they go out and they start the next Avanti and start the next. I think we're on the cusp of a really exciting time here in Utah.
I think we are too. And, you know, when I was at Intel, I kept getting told, look, if you want to move up in your career, you've got to go through Santa Clara. You've got to move to the Bay Area, right? And I looked around. I said, okay, well, if I don't want to stay at Intel, can I be a C-level something here? And there just wasn't a lot in the late 90s here. And so I think I love the fact that Pluralsight, Qualtrics and Domo, and we're getting companies that are headquartered here. There's an opportunity for people to stay. You don't have to move out of here if you want to, you know, advance in your career. And then you're right. The knock-on benefit of you know, getting some liquidity events, getting people, you know, that can then go do what they really want to do. You're right. We're kind of at that early the yeast is, you know, started to rise, you know, create the rising dough, and I think we're going to see some really exciting times.
Well, that's a great note for us to end on. Steve, thanks for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thank you.
Our guest this morning has been Steve Daly, President and CEO of Avanti. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Christian Camargo. You can hear my entire interview with Steve on our website, kcpw.org, or on The Bottom Line podcast. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.